I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Guy Gavriel Kay has just published his newest book, River of Stars. It is described as a major accomplishment and his finest work. It shouldn't be surprising that this book, like his previous ones, is already a bestseller. The book is an epic story inspired by the Song Dynasty. I'll get Mr. Kay, who joins me now, to take us to Kitai as we meet some of the characters. Ren Dayan, a man of destiny whose life is tied to the fate of his land, and Lin Shan, a girl who is intelligent and talented, which isn't really the norm for women of the era. Born in Saskatchewan and raised in Winnipeg, the Toronto-based guy Gavriel Kay has written over a dozen books that have sold millions of copies and that have been critically acclaimed. His books have been translated into over 25 languages, and he's won countless awards for his work. The website for more is at guygavrielkay.ca. There's also a terrific resource on the work of Mr. Kay at brightweavings.com. River of Stars is published by Viking. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Guy Gavriel Kay. Mr. Kay, good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it. Brightweavings.com, you don't run that website, right?
Brightweavings is done for me. I'm one of those ridiculously lucky authors who's had readers and book world people over the years volunteer to help out with the online presence that they've established.
Because I've never read any of your books, barely started this book. So I went to that website to get to know a bit about you and to get to know a bit about your work. And it is a great forum in that you have a lot of people that care about your writing. I mean, what's that like if you're the author?
Well, on the most basic level, the greatest gift readers can give any writer is the luxury of time to do a book properly. I've got enough readers in enough countries around the world who are waiting for the next book, and instead of being caught in the book a year treadmill that so many of my colleagues are, because there's a sufficient number of people who are established as pretty passionate about what I do, I could take my time to try to deliver something that will satisfy me, first of all, and the readers after that.
How long does a book like this take?
I'm writing about a book every 3 years now, which could be annoying and aggravating to my publishers and agents, except that they used to be by now, Joseph. And I can't do it faster because I'm spending about a year and a half doing the reading and research, correspondence, sometimes the travel, into the historical background upon which I build my fantasies based on themes of history.
And the research that one does, do you go to China, for example?
I was in China between my last book, Under Heaven, was also China-inspired. It takes place about 400 years before River of Stars, so it's not a sequel in that sense. But in between the two books, I was in China. I was invited over there for a couple of conferences and speaking engagements. And there was a symposium on my work at the university in Beijing, and six papers were delivered in Chinese. I had an interpreter at my right elbow telling me what they were saying, and I have to tell you, they were saying astonishingly generous things, including one paper on the, not yet in Chinese, Under Heaven, the book inspired by China, and the academic had read the book in English and written a paper in Chinese. And Joseph, he got what I was doing, why I am setting a book in Kitai and not China, why the context is my 12th dynasty of Kitai and not the Song dynasty of China. That slight quarter turn towards the fantastic. This academic at the university in Beijing got it. And I felt enormously validated, ratified, reaffirmed by that. And I think that played a role in my decision to go back and look at another period in Chinese history with the next novel.
The perspective that we get about that part of the world, the Far East, if you will, in terms of going back and creating this world, and you say it's a quarter turn, so it's rooted in, what, three quarters of actual history, and then I guess the last quarter is your own creation.
That's not a bad way to put it. For me, I don't want to write historical fiction that's based on my pretending I know what Henry VIII's favorite position in bed was. I don't want to pretend that I understand the innermost thoughts of real people. I don't want to piggyback my novels on the fame of the characters that I'm pretending I know all about their inner lives. I'm happier doing as much research as I can, grounding myself as well as I can in a period, corresponding with, talking to the scholars who've spent their lives in that period. But then doing that quarter turn so that my characters are invented people inspired by the real people. So if I give you the erotic life of a couple, that's my invented pairing. I'm not telling the reader that I've got some inside information about real people in real times. It's grounded, Joseph, in a measure of respect for real lives actually lived. That quarter turn lets the reader and I share our understanding that when we write about the past, to a certain degree, we are inventing, because we do not know everything there is to know about those previous times.
In the course of your research and in the course of writing these two books, as you have, looking at that part of the world, does it reveal anything about, say, contemporary life there?
Oh, absolutely. It reveals things about contemporary life here, Joseph.
Yeah.
One of the things that absolutely fascinates me about the past, you could say I'm obsessed with thinking about it, it's a duality. On the one hand, the past is astonishingly strange. You know, as Faulkner said, they do things differently there. The past isn't past. We still live thinking about the past. And we make a mistake if we assume that the way people thought and acted, their motivations, were the same as the way we think and act. It's remarkably different. That's one part of the equation. On the other hand, and this fascinates me too, sometimes when you read about events 800 years ago, the Song Dynasty, you see motifs and themes and behavior that are startlingly similar to what we see operating in our own time right now. There's a phrase that comes up all the time in contemporary politics when somebody is accused of fighting the last war. We hear that all the time. It's a mistake that the military or the government make, is that they're so anxious to avoid an error once made that they'll turn themselves inside out to avoid that. They're fighting the last war. Well, River of Stars is based on a culture that turned itself inside out to avoid what it understood as the mistakes of a previous dynasty. It would do anything to avoid those errors, and in the process, it left itself brutally exposed to an entirely different set of threats. We do that today.
And the book talks about military power and the relationship that people have to authority. Do you think, in the course of writing the book, did you think about that a lot? I mean, was it,
absolutely.
We are today?
Yeah. The dynasty had two great fears, as I extracted them from my reading and from my conversations. One was, because there had been a colossal, destructive rebellion centuries back, the kind that it feels like a chasm in the world, that rebellion had been led by military generals and had shattered the previous dynasty. The Song Dynasty were determined to cripple their military, their army, and their leaders. They didn't want any military leader becoming strong enough to threaten the emperor. And their second fear was of women, that they had a perception of the past that so much of the evils of the world came about because there had been a female empress, because various concubines of emperors had had too much influence, that they ended up with a society that was deeply misogynistic, that was opposed to the notion of women having any public presence or role. And I fashion a novel built around two principal characters who are both fighting in their own way against these prejudices, if you will, of their own society, against an idea that we can have a balanced government and military presence that will give us an adequate protection against outsiders while not threatening the throne, and that women don't have to be seen and viewed as entirely submissive and subjugated. That's the underpinning of River of Stars.
I'd like to talk about Lin Shan, because I haven't finished the book, obviously, but I've been reading about her in reviews and the sort, and she just seems like a fascinating character that I'm looking forward to reading about her in this book. Was she a typical woman of the era?
Absolutely not, but she was inspired by a real person.
Pardon me for interrupting, but there were people like her at the time, just probably not reported in history, right?
She's based on the most famous female poet in Chinese history, the most beloved and admired figure. It's a poet named Li Qingchao. And Li Qingchao was a poet of the Song Dynasty in the 12th century. And we have her poetry and songs, a number of them preserved. We also have some prose writings from her. And we know a reasonable amount about her biography. We know some things about her life. And she was educated by her father, who was a minor figure at the court, a nondescript but mildly respected court gentleman. And the only reckless thing her father did, and I've used this in the novel for my character of Lin Shan, the only reckless thing her father did was educate his daughter as if she was a boy. Give her the training and the education as if she was a young man aspiring to take the examinations that led you to power in government. So Shan is inspired by a genuinely fascinating but anomalous real woman in history. And Joseph, that was my way in, because I don't want to write books where I am imposing 21st century personalities and values on 12th century China or 6th century Byzantium, as I did in the previous book. I want my characters to feel legitimate in their time and place, even if they're not, quote-unquote, normal for that time. I like finding examples of real figures to give me a starting point for shaping my creations. And Lin Shan is absolutely inspired by someone who actually lived in that time.
Do you have to like your characters when you're writing them? Do you have to like them?
I have to be interested in them.
Yeah.
I've written some characters, many characters I despise. I've written characters that I hope the reader will despise. I'll be worried if a reader loves certain of my characters.
Yeah.
We have a problem, Houston.
Yeah.
But I am. Somebody once said that, or wrote, that Kay has never met a secondary character he didn't like. And it's mostly true if you mean by like, be interested in. I'm interested in even the marginal, minor figures that come into the book, because I want to, the minute I start writing about them, I want to know a little bit more about them. And I want the reader to care about even the secondary and tertiary characters. I believe that that's what draws people deeply into a book, that immerses you in a novel, is that you're engaged by not just the one or two central dominant figures, but you're engaged by the supporting cast as well. You care about them.
Yeah. The setting of the book was established in the last book. I mean, it's the same universe, essentially. But when you start a book like this, do you have the characters in mind first, or is it the plot, the story? What comes first for you?
Good question. My answer, and I always give this caveat, whatever I'm about to say, it's about me, not meant as a prescriptive suggestion for any other writer.
Writers,
I worry
yeah.
about novelists saying, this is how you do it.
Yeah.
every time I see one of those newspaper and magazine pieces where established successful writers tell the young ones how it's done,
yeah.
I roll my eyes like a 16-year-old because it's too personal. So if I tell you that I usually need to start with the setting has to come first. I need to know where I'm going and when. And then I need, usually again, I need my themes, my motifs. Why am I about to spend 3 years telling this story? What do I want to share with the reader? What do I want the reader to take away from my book? Those aren't always the themes that end up dominating, because as I write the book, new things come in. But I need some sense of why I'm going there. Then the characters start to grow or build from my research and my reading. I start seeing figures like Li Chengchao, who gave me Lin Shan, mm-hmm. or the great Chinese general, Yue Fei was his name, who gave me Ren Dian, the male protagonist. These real people inspired some ideas for characters for me. And the very last thing, usually, because I discover it as I go along, is the narrative. Is that I really do believe, but this is just me, doesn't mean everyone else has to write this way, I really do believe that if a book is a discovery process for a writer, that some of that sense of discovery, of finding out as you go what's about to happen, comes through subliminally into the reader's awareness as they're reading the book. They end up with some of that energy of what's coming next that might keep them up till 3 a.m, which is what I want to do, of course.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that it's the process is too personal for you. Is it a solitary experience, writing?
Writing is intensely solitary. What we're doing right now, a conversation in Vancouver while I'm on a book tour, talking about River of Stars, all over the place, is almost shockingly in contrast with the everyday normal get up and do your intravenous coffee and sit at the desk and produce words in solitude. One of the things that's happened, Joseph, and it's interesting when I talk to other writers about this, is that the online world, the presence of the internet, is actually threatening or breaking for many writers the solitude, the silence, the focus that they need, because our workspace has become our play space.
Yeah.
It's so easy. If you are blocked on a chapter, it's so easy to say, check my email, see what's happening on Twitter, check the box score for my baseball team.
Yeah.
It's so easy with a click of a button to swing into recreational mode. And there used to be some deterrence between your focus and the breaking of your focus. I remember I wrote my first novel on a village on the south coast of Crete in Greece. And I was smart enough back then in my early 20s to know that temptation would lie down in the harbor where the cafes and bars were.
Yeah.
And I booked myself a hotel, Joseph, at the absolute top of the village, the highest point on the hill where there was a hotel, to keep as much space between myself and a gin and tonic or a coffee on the harbor, because there was a distance between focus and distraction. Right now, it's at the keyboard.
And you obviously write with a computer?
I do now, yes.
Yeah.
My first three books I wrote longhand.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not old.
And when does a person first read it after you've written it? And who is that?
The first reader?
Yeah.
My first trusted reader, my first reader who's going to be going through it and offering me specific comments, is my youngest brother, who's a psychoanalyst, who's also a writer, the editor of a medical literary magazine. He is, of course, as a youngest brother, he has to be a pain in the neck, but he's also a terrifically sharp reader, and he's the one who gets the book first, and whose initial feedback I'm waiting for. And then I work through my editors, my principal editors are people I've worked with for a long time, and my agents are also people I've now been working with for a great many years. But I'll start with my brother.
And what's the process like in terms of once a reader, like the person who picks up the book, reads it, and if they have something interesting to say, an interesting view, an interesting opinion, or an idea, does that influence, say, when you're writing the next book?
I'm a stubborn, prairie-born, oldest child, Joseph. I'm really tough to shake and influence in that way. I mean, I'm putting that flippantly, but I also think if you aspire to more than just short-term entertainment, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you want to write something that's more than what someone reads on the beach, on holiday, or on the airplane, after the snack and before falling asleep, if you're serious about your work, you can't let yourself be too hyper-conscious, hyper-vigilant of market trends or instant feedback. I think that that's a bit of a trap that some young writers are busy chasing. Hollywood is the best example of this. They're always chasing what the focus group, what the market feedback is telling them. This year they want zombies. Mm-hmm. By the time that zombie movie is out in the screens 2.5 years later, they don't want zombies anymore. I think it's a mistake, especially if you're working, as I do, on a 3-year-plus curve for producing a book, to think too much about short-term market response. I'm obviously reading my reviews. I don't believe writers who say they don't. I'm reading my reviews. I'm tracking the responses to the book. I feel deeply rewarded when intelligent people say generous and intelligent things about my writing. River of Stars has been wonderfully, generously responded to in the first weeks. We're only like 10 days, 2 weeks after publication, so it's early, early days. But it was number one on the Maclean's bestseller list in Canada in the first week. The first reviews have been tremendously reassuring. But I can't cater what I do next based on the short-term feedback to a given book.
Our mutual friend Rob Wiersma penned one of the best reviews, I think, of this book, and he writes, River of Stars is a sort of novel one disappears into, emerging shaken, if not outright changed, a novel of destiny, and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's pretty good.
That's about as good as it can get. If you're going to have a review in the Globe and Mail in Canada, that's as generous. One of the things I really like, Joseph, this is the reader in me, not just the writer, is that I've noticed in the last week or 10 days a remarkable number of the reviews of River of Stars show reviewers trying to write as well as they can in the review. It's that one of the common themes is because I take my time writing the book, one of the things I take my time with is the actual sentence-by-sentence writing. It's that I think that the way a story is told has to dovetail with the story that's being told. They're not separate things. They fit together. And I'm noticing, and I'm smiling, to see a number of reviewers turning quite elegant, stylish phrases in their reviews of the book. And that one you just quoted from Rob Wilson has a lovely bit of writing.
Yeah, it is. He's a very good writer himself. When you were growing up as a prairie boy, was this the sort of stuff that you like? I know you don't like to be categorized as a fantasy writer and the sort, but I mean, is this the genre that you read in?
No. I was reading right across the board. Yeah. I read everything.
And you still read
comic books? Yeah. I read Archie comics, and I read Hardy Boy mysteries, and I read War and Peace, and I read Thomas Wolfe, and I read Hemingway and Faulkner. Then I went back to Archie comics.
Yeah.
And I read a lot of historical fiction when I was young, so history was always one of the things that drew me. But the fantasy bug as such hit hard with reading Lord of the Rings as very early adolescent. But I was never a fantasy junkie. I read mostly the pre-Tolkien books. After I found Tolkien, I went back to some of his predecessors, William Morris, Lord Dunsany, James Banch Cabo, Eric Addison, people whose names are almost unknown now, but they were giants of early fantasy writing. I never became someone who was playing Dungeons and Dragons or was reading the 5, 6, 10-volume fantasy series that followed Tolkien. I wrote one high fantasy trilogy. My first published books, The Beyond About Tapestry, were what I called then and now my statement in high fantasy. And I felt, I suppose, a little bit of a platform to make a statement because, as you may know, my breakthrough in publishing, not for my own, not for awareness in the public eye, but in the publishing world, was that I was retained by the estate of Tolkien.
By Christopher Tolkien, right?
Yeah. The estate retained me to assist in the editorial construction of The Silmarillion, which was the first of the posthumously published Tolkien books. So I had a gateway into publishing because the industry knew who I was. But fantasy was not, as a child, my own drug of choice. History was always somewhat closer to what drew me as a reader.
The experience working with Christopher Tolkien and getting immersed in the works of Tolkien, did that teach you anything about being a writer? And did it inspire?
You'd have to be pretty dull and dead not to have learned some things from a year like that. But the things it taught me aren't necessarily the ones that would leap to mind if somebody were just looking at that experience from the outside. One of the lessons, one of the most important lessons for me, was something we've just been talking about, which is taking your time. That, now, Tolkien took the idea of taking your time to the extent of 5 decades.
To death, even.
Really. He began The Silmarillion in 1917, recovering from trench fever in World War I, and he was still fiddling and working on notes for it when he died in 1973. But watching how many drafts, how many false starts, how many revisions of sentences and paragraphs, whole scenes that would be crossed out and start again from scratch, watching the craft element, if we want to talk about craft, the patience involved in building something significant and substantial. And this was true of Lord of the Rings as well, of course. That patience and time aspect of the writer's craft locked into me very young from my year there, that I've never felt an inclination to rush the writing, to skip the revising and the polishing. It seems to me that's just integral to what you have to do if you want to write a book that stays with people after they've finished the last page.
You've written over a dozen books. I guess, what is this, 13, 14?
This is the 12th novel.
The 12th novel, and there's a book of poetry too, right? Is this the best time for you as a writer? Do you find that you're at the top of your game?
Well, that's really for you to say, and for Rob to say, and for any reader who's picking up the book and reading it. It's very difficult. In fact, it's almost impossible for any writer to evaluate where a given book fits into their own hierarchy of their own works. We're too close to them. And right now, in particular, I'm way too close to River of Stars. I mean, I've just finished the last revisions a few months ago. I went through the last proofreading, and I'm one of those writers that publishers hate in one regard, because I'm still making changes at the stage when you're only supposed to be checking if the semicolons are in the right place.
Yeah.
I'm still fiddling with words and phrases at the last minute. I have this image sometimes of myself running after the manuscript with a pen in hand saying, wait, wait.
But is this the most fun, the most enjoyable for you this time?
The most enjoyable time, again, this is just me, the most enjoyable part of any book is the research. That's because I'm just learning stuff, Joseph. And by definition, because I've decided all by myself that I'm interested in this and I want to know more, it's not as if some professor has said, okay, you're going to learn about the 17th century and you're going to like it. I'm learning something that I've decided intrigues me. And I'm making notes, and I'm writing people, and I'm discovering some really interesting people in correspondence, making friends. I'm making these early forays of what I might do with it, but I don't have any responsibility yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's only after a certain period of time when there's a nagging voice starts to get louder and says, you know, if you don't write a book about this, the mortgage isn't going to get paid. And I say to the nagging voice, shut up, I'm having fun, and the nagging voice, as nagging voices do, keeps going.
Yeah.
That's when it starts to become burdensome, demanding, stressful, the process of trying to write something that will come close to what I want the book to be. And I'm not able to decide with any of them in the period just after they're finished the level of success I've had with that. That's why I need the input of people I trust, reviewers, readers, to say whether or not they think a given book is how far up the pantheon of my own work it lies.
It's been such a pleasure to meet you and an honor to talk to you today. I appreciate you coming in to do this and continued good luck with the book. I guess you don't need luck anymore because it's the number one on the list. So thanks for coming in.
Okay, take good care.
GuyGavrielK.ca is a website. The book is called River of Stars. It's published by Viking. Its author, Guy Gavriel K., joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.